Microphone check. 1, 2. The microphone check. 1, 2, 1, 2. The microphone check. I got my headphones tuned between two different AM stations, and my briefcase is full of declassified information. Declassified, declassified, and I'm reading it under the lens of your radio. I'm dissecting it and bleeding it. I read the world for breakfast, and after lunch I write it. I let me get me down, and then I stand back up and fight it. I read the news today, oh boy, oh boy. I know linguistics, statistics, pundits, and mystics. I voted for Ralph Nader. I read Docs and Raider. I got 1,000 signatures and sent them to Darth Vader. I'm reading U.S. News and World Report, Time Life, and The Post. I know more than other DJs because I read the most. And when I squint to the west, I can see Afghanistan. I put my head between my knees and I can see Iran. I get documents online and then I analyze them. They knows I'm out there waiting so they don't declassify them. I bug the White House and I bug the Pentagon. In the filling in my molar, I got my de-scrambler on. I got the truth. I got Paul Muth. We got better lines than Haydn Carruth. We put our 11 cents in, just like Marx and Lenin. Paul's like Carl McCartney, but I'm John Lennon. We'd love to turn you on. I say I want a revolution, and I want to stop it all. I finished all 3 volumes up of Marx's Capital. You know, everything that old boy wrote is up on my shelf, and every single bit I translated myself. I'm reading and I'm learning, and when the tide is turning, it'll warm my heart in part to see the dollar bills burning. They weren't built in a day, but all roads lead to Rome. I'll do fine just as the Romans with my main man, Noam. I'd like to tell you a story about a little man, if I can. A gnome whose name was Chomsky. I'm MCS Tazaruk. I got a voice like milk. I'm the best dressed man you ever heard. Can you hear this tie? It's silk.
It's mid-morning on the last day of the week, and you're listening to News from Neptune. Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth discussing the news of the week and its coverage by the media. Archives of this show in free software formats are available at newsfromneptune.com. Thanks to the technical expertise of Dr. No, Jeff Nicholson Owens.
And Happy New Year, Paul. It's the 31st of December. I sort of like this arrangement, you know, of having having our programs on the Saturday before the holiday, as they said carefully.
Today Christmas, is the holiday, isn't
Christmas
it?
Christmas and, well, yeah, but the 1st of January, I was thinking. But,
right.
Yeah, you're right. But it's not bad. Our thought is to... less to talk about a review of the year than to talk about where we are now, and it seems to me that'll give us plenty of room to move around, right?
I think so, and I already celebrated my year-end feast since I'm more pagan than anything else, I guess. So,
How did you...
The 21st solstice was...
Oh, the solstice, yeah. I see. Yeah, okay.
Lit a bonfire in the backyard, I guess.
You Mithraists have your own
that's where the blood sacrifice came from for the whole business, isn't it?
I'm not sure. I mean, yeah. Blood sacrifice, you know, everybody was into that in some form or another, so it's and probably still are, so that probably hasn't changed too much. But... in any case, I think if think about where we are right now and where we were a year ago. I mean, a year ago we were bemoaning the re-election of the present administration, and after another year of their machinations and the deaths of many people around the world for which they're responsible, it seems to me that there's almost a hopeful note in the air, reversed as it is, in that people are actually talking about impeachment now. The word has emerged, and the circumstances, which have always been propitious for impeachment, at least the list of high crimes and misdemeanors this administration is responsible for, has been there all along. But now, at least, there's some talk about it in by the official mentioner, so to speak, and it may be a topic.
I think it went away for the holiday season, though, and all I've been hearing is that even though the bump up that Bush has supposedly got in the ratings is still barely over the margin of error in the polls. They still say, "Well, yeah. he's fighting his way back and all sorts of things like that.
Of course they do. I mean, that's what they're supposed to say. That's
what the mentioners are saying, in my opinion, most of them, the so-called liberal ones, too.
But I think other people, well, exactly. I think what other people are looking at, though, I mean, the spying scandal is interesting, the NSA scandal, and particularly as it expands. A week ago last Friday, the Times, the Friday news always, as we say, the Friday news is the news to look at because there's where the things are dumped that people don't want to be don't want to have noticed. So a week ago Friday, we get from the New York Times the information that the NSA spying scandal is much broader and included many more people than the administration has been admitting, and that it is an increasingly big deal, and people are taking it that way. I think there's a little. There's a little sort of political metonymy going on here, Paul, taking the part for the whole. You know, the same thing happened in the Watergate affair. We were talking about this a while ago, that when Nixon was essentially forced out of office by the threat of impeachment, the specific issues alleged really were fairly insignificant. I mean, Watergate was a third-rate burglary, as Nixon's flack said. But what Nixon was forced out for was the Vietnam War, that it was a ritual of expiation. Maybe back to your Mithraism
here. Well, the order of... order of impeachment included bombing Cambodia and things
like
that.
It did, but that one was eliminated. Yes, those articles were proposed, but they were sheared off all along, and the issue became Watergate and the cover up. I mean, an internal matter in some sense to the American government. And that those were the things that ostensibly forced Nixon's removal. What I'm saying is that it occurred in a context where the real issue was the Vietnam War, and it seems to me that there's a certain sense in which we can read the present situation in the same way. That sure, the NSA spying thing is a big deal, a much bigger deal than Watergate, certainly. But still, what's at stake here is... something in the national consciousness about killing several hundred thousand Arabs in pursuit of political goals for the wealthy and powerful in the U.S., about which the public has been told vast numbers of lies. This is what the administration would properly be impeached for.
What did you make of, again, to go back to this Wayne Madsen fellow? He's cited in Cursor. Cursor.org is a great source out of Minneapolis for a lot of... a lot of stories that are sort of breaking in various covers of the alternative press as well. And he's saying that the NSA source for him is suggesting that there was actually spying on internal employees, perhaps the ones that were leaking, and perhaps the journalists as well, targeting individual journalists. Now, I don't know what... this is the first I've heard of this, and I don't know what it's really based on, but if any of that's happening. However, it seems that administration thinks the best defense is a counter offense, and they're actually going to be probably raking some time journalists. This guy, again, an unlikely hero, the guy that's writing the book that eventually released this story. When we look back a year, you know, this is about, you know, a year ago is when the Times actually found out about this story.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Held it so long. We have to note that.
And we also found out that the president was calling in editors from the Times and the Post and telling them to hold stories to keep lids on things and so forth. Effectively, at least for the Times, a year ago, people have speculated what would it mean if this story appeared before the November 2004 election, and indeed, it might have made a difference. It's the news management by the official media has been quite remarkable and is being exposed in this in the present situation. That too is good.
Coburn on Counterpunch. I didn't read the article, but I heard this media roundtable that featured him out of San Francisco. That I recommend your call radio.org. It's formerly Laura Flanders' show. I think she started it, and actually the manager of that station is the woman that was forced out during the Pacific brouhaha some years ago, Nicole Soraya. So she's
what's her name?
Nicole Soraya
oh, yeah.
was manager at KPFA when the coup happened
oh, I
and
see.
All that.
Uh-huh.
So she's now with KALW, which has a show. And Alexander was on. He was talking about an article that was featured on Counterpunch where he compares Cy Hirsch's revelatory articles on the Nixon wiretapping exposure to the current one,
uh-huh.
and points out that the you know Cy Hirsch wraps it up and is quite unequivocal, whereas the current article
oh, yes,
is so
right.
is so garbed with qualifications
yeah.
and you know allowing that you know well you know maybe it is a new era and maybe it is time for something like this et cetera, which
a very good point and you know it's I don't think we have to include from that there were giants in the earth in those days and that we now are. Reduced to the pygmies we see around us. They've always been pygmies. This metaphor is a bit out of hand. I don't really mean to apply to Cy Hirsch, but the point is that the news management that's going on now is it more effective than the news about My Lai that came forth from My Lai and the Watergate affair that came forth from Cy Hirsch a generation ago. That much is true. It certainly is more managed now.
Something that you have to look around for in the alternative press, and even there, I think people are on holidays. But there's sort of an oil coup in Iraq. If you notice, Chalabi has managed
look
to
look who's
be,
back.
He didn't get any seats in the
right.
He's not seated in the parliament at all. But there was a backroom deal with the current authorized government, not the newly elected one, which is who knows when that'll actually form. With the IMF to raise the gas prices
substantially
immediately after the election, and we know how much is going on with the gas prices here. And I was looking around a little bit to see if anybody's writing on whether how much strategic of oil reserves, which Bush and his oligarchy was dead set against releasing so many so stalwartly. I think they used the incident of Katrina to open up the reserves so that the gas price would go down here, and it's that may be more to do with Bush's bump up in the poll than anything than anybody in his administration has said.
I think you're right.
I think that if people were trying to imagine themselves in a situation with a contested election. Yeah, and the gas price is going up immediately after, let's say, 2000, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
how much anger in the streets were, and it's resulted in this escalation of intimidation and the shutting down of a refinery.
Yeah,
and I wonder whether it'll be run by military officers sometime soon. If you know, they're shutting it down because nobody wants to truck the refined products anymore, it seems, but. This would be a drastic instance here, and it's extremely drastic there, and it just kind of undercuts any kind of slow march to normalcy image that Bush and crew are trying to pretend to.
Yeah, I think in Iraq, gasoline prices have quadrupled, as you say, immediately after the election. Much talk of blaming it on attack on an oil refinery, and part of the resistance to the occupation has always been an attack on the infrastructure, the oil infrastructure. The replacement of the oil minister with the omnipresent Mr. Chalabi seems to have been predicated in part by the fact that this oil minister, I mean, he's a member of the puppet government after all, but he was objecting to this raise in the gasoline prices, which, of course, have hurts people across Iraq rather substantially. And it was his objection to the raise in those prices that meant that he was eased out. He was suspended, I think was the word that AP used. He was suspended. I mean, in Iraq, maybe that's not a metaphor, so, you know, but in this case, he was suspended from his job, and Chalabi is has a day job again. So I don't know. I turned on the TV last night and saw Chalabi's mouthpiece Judith Miller talking away about how, gee, it's tough because she's not really writing about what's going on there right now as she did once before, and therefore, you know, we really don't know what's happening.
So, where what venue did she have?
This was a C-SPAN forum on the media, of course, you know, with all the usual people, and it was. But now that she's got her, you know, six-figure settlement or whatever it was with the Times, she can she's able to talk publicly again.
Is that what it was?
And oh, I think it was more than that. I think it was more than a million, but nobody, you know, haven't heard.
Some of that's hush money for her affair with the publishers.
Could well
too.
Be. Yeah. Could well be. Yes.
Anyway,
Judy apparently was. Willing to spread her journalistic favors and others about, so it was, yeah.
Maybe they went together.
Yeah, maybe they did. But the oil issue had an interesting, more or less local aspect. I gather there's a story that I've not got the details on, but apparently Chicago or. And I don't know who, and I want to find out who turned down a. An offer from Venezuela through Citgo to provide cheap heating oil, as Venezuela was for New York and Boston.
No. We covered this already. It's against the law to burn heating oil, use heating oil in Chicago. So there was no out. Now they may have rejected the offer of diesel fuel for the buses. I understand it's $2 a bus ride in Chicago now, and Well, you didn't attend the Venezuelan consulate when he spoke here. He mentioned that. Actually, the backstory on that whole deal was through Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson was watching Katrina with Hugo Chavez in Caracas, and they were the ones that actually decided to make this kind of overture to the poor kind of.
Jesse Jackson, the elder.
Yeah.
And
I'm
a little surprised to hear Jesse Jackson taking credit for what went on.
Jesse Jackson didn't take credit for it. It was the Venezuelan consul from Chicago. Apparently, this young guy that was in town. I played the address. I don't know if I played the section where he talked about Jackson, but being in Caracas watching Katrina happen. So it wasn't I, you know, in fact, Jackson hasn't made any press releases about this. I heard it. I was surprised to hear it from the Venezuelan consul. But he went on to say that they were negotiating to do some lower price diesel if they could see that there would be some kind of reflection of the cost of the bus fare. Because it's now $2 a ride in Chicago, I guess. So that if you have to catch two buses round one way and a round trip, that's $8 out of your low wage scale.
That's substantial, certainly.
Pretty prohibitive.
Yeah.
So I don't know where you got this idea that Chicago rejected it.
We'll check that out and find out what's going on about that.
I was curious about it.
The best information about this often comes from the foreign press. I think that it was the Financial Times, but I'm not sure, and I can't find it right now. So we'll have to see.
They may not have anybody on the ground that knows that, you know, whether it's because Texas Panhandle Gas Company has had somebody in the previous daily administration. It is illegal. Heating oil is not used in Chicago.
And why should that be? I mean, whose interest? That doesn't sound.
Well, it might be Texas Panhandle. It might be the fact that actually diesel is. I mean, oil is nastier. It has more soot than natural gas.
I hear you know, coal interests or various certain other groups who would be interested in having something like that. I'm cynical enough to believe it's not necessarily for the benefit of the populace.
Well, that's why I introduced Texas Panhandle. You hear these Ameren ads saying that we don't make any money on the gas. We just make money on servicing. This is our local crisis with the natural gas prices.
Here's the situation in Chicago. The Chicago Transit Authority is refusing an opportunity to alleviate commuting costs for hundreds of thousands in Chicago's low-income neighborhoods. Instead of accepting deeply discounted fuel from the Venezuela-owned Citgo Petroleum Corporation, the city is instead raising fares to solve budget shortfalls. In an October meeting with representatives from the CTA, the city's Department of Energy and other city officials, Citgo unveiled a plan to provide Chicago with low-cost diesel fuel. The company's stipulation at the bidding of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, Venezuela owned Citgo, of course, was that the CTA in turn passed those savings on to poor residents in the form of free or discounted fare cards. But 2 months later, despite claims of a looming budget crisis, the CPA president, quote, has no intent or plan to accept the offer.
Well, we that is not heating oil. That is the transit.
Yes. But the point is,
and the
point is that that Chicago turned down this offer of, of cheap petroleum from Venezuela. It's been accepted by in Boston and in New York, and there the people who organized it were the local Congress people, Congressman Serrano in the Bronx and. Delahunt in Chicago and Boston, if I remember.
I don't think it was actually done through the municipal government, so they actually were doing it because of the situation in Chicago being different. That they couldn't make a deal for heating oil. People don't use it. They thought, well, let's try something else. And as the date of this speaker of the Venezuelan consulate being in town, they were still negotiating about it. And apparently, they don't want to take any largesse from the. Fuhrer in the Caribbean Sea, as we might be calling him someday soon, I guess.
In place of the proposed discount, which the CTA apparently does not want Chicagoans to even know about, budget shortfalls will be addressed by fare hikes. And fare, F-A-R-E, hikes, not
unfair hikes.
Unfair fare hikes. Chicagoans who are unaware of the Venezuela offer will be hit with an increase of 25 cents per ride, and discounted route-to-route transfers will be eliminated for passengers paying cash.
You don't think the Chicago Tribune picked up that story from the Financial Times?
I don't think I saw it. I didn't see it in the Chicago Tribune. That's the point. And the story is not being told. And I was going to say further that if indeed the point people on these negotiations were Congress people, then we can assume that powerful congressman in Illinois right now is Rahm Emanuel, who is carefully removing candidates who might be Democratic candidates who might be in a position to win in the 2006 election if they're anti-war. Rahm Emanuel, who was a Clinton creature and bought himself basically a congressional seat in Chicago in 2002, is head of the Democratic Congressional Committee, which is basically in charge of overseeing House candidates in the 2006 election, and it's quite remarkable how they are excluding people who are anti-war. Henry Hyde, for example, was almost beaten in the last congressional election in this state by an independent Democratic candidate, such as the one we have in this district, she tends to run against Hyde again with even a better chance of beating him now that the anti-war issue has emerged even more clearly, and Rahm Emanuel is finding candidates to run against her in the Democratic primary to make sure that an anti-war candidate does make a challenge to Henry Hyde. So this is what we're getting this is what we're getting from our local congresspeople, Democratic congresspeople.
Well, maybe Jesse Jackson Jr. will come up with some way that CITGO can help the poor I was thinking, fantasizing. We have a CITGO, by the way. You can drive north on Market Street and gas up. I've been doing fairly regularly.
Been doing it myself.
Maybe Jesse Jackson Jr. will negotiate something where people with public aid cards can get a gas card.
Might be worthwhile to get in touch with him and suggest it then, because he's certainly been quiet about it.
Maybe they're doing something. But I think the tendency towards cooperative things, actually the deals that they're working out in Boston and New York are don't like give vouchers for heating oil. They give heating oil discounts to particularly community organizations, and then the money that they've saved is turned around into the community organization. So they seem to have rather than helping someone, an individual, they seem to be inclined to try to work out modalities of this aid that can be helping a group or
the idea is to get it immediately to the people who need it in Boston and the Bronx.
Well, so. Whereas it would have been a great idea for them to help out. I couldn't believe when I heard it was $2 a bus ride in Chicago. That's outrageous.
Amazing, isn't it?
Anyway, why don't we leap into some other issues about Latin America, since we've been talking about Chavez. Evo Morales is still hanging out in Havana. I don't know. I guess he's probably back in the high Andes.
But boy, is that upsetting the folks in Washington, huh?
It's noting that Mark Weisbrot was on the Liar Hour talking, and he was paired with the apparatchik that was engineering the coup against Chavez, Noriega. It was pretty amazing. They were pretty collegial. I haven't written them yet.
That's embarrassing. But that shouldn't be.
Well, but Weisbrot didn't. He was collegial in undercutting Noriega's arguments. I mean, he wasn't strident about it, which is probably a good tactic on that sedate show. But he did point out that Noriega was in the position of suggesting that it was the 500-year legacy of European colonialism that was causing all the problems in Bolivia. That, you know, and it was different from other parts of Latin America, which, you know, was immediately generated the question, well, didn't 500 years of colonialism affect the rest of Latin America and Central America and, as well? And it was really bizarre. In fact, it seemed really strange to hear Noriega making that point, but he had to explain the lack of progress in particularly in Bolivia, but all over Latin America, that Weisbrot and his group at Center for Economic and Policy Research has done so well in.
But it's a standard move, Paul, for the American government to try to say, oh, what we're dealing with here is a race issue in Bolivia, because Morales, we're talking about Evo Morales, the new president of Bolivia, who is an indigene. I mean, he's and the first one who has ever been in political charge in Bolivia since the independence of Bolivia some, you know, in the 19th century. I'm not at all surprised to hear the the official government line saying, "Oh well, this is a matter of oppressed races." Because what he doesn't want to talk about is what Morales talks about, which is class.
Yeah.
I mean, Morales' party is called a Movement for Socialism. Was the word socialism mentioned on that hour?
I think they identified him as being with that organization. But Noriega
and Morales
actually
himself in Havana made a point of saying that he represented the second generation of the social revolution that began with Cuba in 59, and that was the theme of his comments there. The reason the U.S. is upset about what's going on in the Andean region in South America has little to do with whether Indians or non-Indians are in charge. It has a great deal to do with the political ideas of those people who are in charge, and since those ideas are clearly anti-imperial and socialist in the case of Morales, Washington would love to send the 82nd Airborne if they only could.
Yeah. Noriega is identified as a farmer official.
Yeah.
He's probably working underground. He couldn't actually get confirmed through the Senate.
That's
but they
true.
Could have taken him in the National Security Agency, since that's one of their ways of doing that, or done a Bolton end-of-term appointment. But maybe they decide he's better as an outside operator. But they didn't actually have an official representative. But it was pretty much I'm sure mirrors pretty much the U.S. line on the issue. Empire Notes, Rahul Mahajan has a nice piece on Bolivian, and he captures the long and sordid history of Bolivia in one line. Through massacre, genocide, slavery, revolution, counter-revolution, and a staggering 188 military coups, in one of which the United States, working with Klaus Barbie the Nazi, helped install perhaps the only government in the world history run by drug traffickers. So if they're going to if they're going to go after Evo Morales for being head of the peasant coca grower group and being a drug lord, it would be a little embarrassing to remind them that they helped install Klaus Barbie in the cocaine coup, as it's called, not so very long ago. I guess that was in the mid 70s, right?
Klaus Barbie being the Nazi, the Gauleiter that wasn't his, I don't know, whatever
Butcher
his name
Leon,
was,
yeah.
In southern France, who was spirited out of France by the American army and sent to Latin America, an example of the outreach of the U.S. at the end of the Second World War. I mean, look, the U.S. can run the drug business. Remember, as a propaganda line, with ease. Remember, after the embarrassing fall of communism, which left the U.S. with an enemies gap, and the U.S. needed to invade Panama, and it suddenly discovered that the leader of Panama, another Noriega, on the other side, so to speak, was a drug dealer. Now, this was a guy who had been and supported and indeed on the CIA payroll for a long time. But once he gets off the reservation, as Saddam Hussein was to discover a little later, things could get very bad indeed. Well, the U.S. had an excuse now. It couldn't say that we're going after this guy because he's instituting communism, but we could say he's a drug dealer. And the U.S. will certainly trot that out as soon as possible.
They might have some tamale flour in his freezer, too, they did with Noriega.
Or pornography.
We have a message from the Labor Hour here, or some kind of announcement, perhaps. We're about halfway through.
This whole deal with the city of Chicago and Sitco, there was an article in the Chicago Standard, and basically why the Daley administration turned Sitco's offer down was because they're about ready to receive some, I think, $80-90 million from the federal government in public transportation infrastructure money.
And it would have looked bad for them to be consorting
with Chavez. You could probably use your imagination to imagine that the Bush administration told them...
Doesn't mean they're going to move the fare back down, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I think that was part of the deal of receiving that money as well, is not just to turn down Sitco's offer, but to increase the fares. I mean, it fits hand in glove with the IMF policies.
Thanks, Dave.
Dave Johnson from the Labor Hour. You're listening to News from Neptune, Carl Estabrook and Paul Muth talking about the news of the year and its coverage by the media. And we got a lot to do in the last half hour here, my friend.
Since we haven't been here, I haven't been here. I don't know what, you didn't run the Chomsky last week, I guess, because Amy upstaged you, or did you indeed?
Last week in this hour, we ran a recent talk, the Iqbal Ahmad Memorial Lecture by Noam Chomsky, delivered 8 weeks ago in Massachusetts. That was a very interesting summary, I thought, of the present situation. And we may hear that again.
Left Dershowitz out, huh?
That's well, cool. the debate between Alan Dershowitz and Noam Chomsky is very much worth listening to. It's available online right now. It was excerpted on Democracy Now! And played here. It's important and worthwhile, and definitely should be attended to, because that issue is obfuscated as fast as any foreign policy issue, as any political issue in the United States. More lies are told about it, and that's saying something, than anything else. And a little disambiguation, as they say at Wikipedia, is important.
That issue being the middle
Israel-Palestine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I would say probably faster than most, actually.
Yep.
They're better disassemblers, as Bush might say, on that score.
Go ahead.
I was going to mention that I guess they took a holiday on PBS and ran the Reagan documentary again. It made one regurgitate the first time, but they played it again. And I was struck by the irony of them having this rather adulatory 4-hour documentary on PBS. And then the Liar Hour, which I praised for having Mark Weisbrot on. This is the PBS News Hour with Jim Lehrer. When he's away, it seems to be better, actually. They had Steve Zunes on last night, in fact, and that was a pretty good stroke. Middle East expert, writes for Counterpunch, I think, from time to time, out of the Bay Area.
Right.
But the news coverage they had the day before on Guatemala and the exhuming of graves that's still going on. We hear a lot about the exhuming of graves in Iraq, and because they're the appropriate victims, I guess. But there was no mention again. This happened so many times when they talk about Central America. It's sort of like this was, you know, those generals down there, and there's no mention of U.S. involvement at all in the slaughter of the Mayans and others in Guatemala. And they had this long, rather well-done piece about this people dedicated to the forensics and the gruesome details of digging up these mass graves. But again, no mention of Reagan administration's role at all. No, it was just like the U.S.'s backyard, it's being dug up, but the U.S. had nothing to do with it, apparently, according to the Liar Hour.
That's a popular topic now, and if one wants to think, psychologically, you wonder why there's such an enthusiasm, apparently, for crime shows right now that have to do with forensics and digging up graves. The very good novel from a couple of years ago started the trend, at least as far as I know, literarily. But this explosion of television interest, I mean, what's going on here? What's in the national consciousness about this? Is it part of the propaganda understanding that still remains the major prop for the Iraq War? after all, he used weapons of mass destruction, already a propaganda term, on his own people, that this is this to my amazement, remains the sort of justification of the war that I think has the most currency right now. Yeah. Because no one believes the we're spreading democracy line. Christopher Hitchens was on an extended version of C-SPAN over the weekend and a talk that he had given in October. And as one of the more articulate defenders of the Bush position, he was presenting this, well, after all, Saddam Hussein gassed his own people. He pointed out that it was in fact they were in fact Kurds. What's going on here, Paul? I mean, is this this CSI approach part of the Bush era propaganda?
I think it reflects a cultural what is that, return of the repressed kind of thing. All the dead bodies around. And what's curious is that there used to be cop shows where, you know, and Perry Mason kind of shows where an innocent person was, you know, gotten off in court. Now everything is predicated on getting the right evidence to throw them in the slammer. That's culturally. And there's a new show now called Injustice, which is, you know, finally come around with all of the evidence of people, even a Republican governor of some doubtful credibility here in Illinois giving a moratorium because he realized how many people were on death row through snitches and jailhouse confessions and outright torture, some techniques in Chicago that were learned in Vietnam, apparently, how to do it with electricity better. So I think it's interesting to note that there's finally one of these popular culture items that's actually talking about getting somebody off who's falsely accused.
But I think you're closer to it in saying that the point of these crime dramas on television and so forth are to prove people guilty by, quote, scientific, close quote, methods. This is what's going on. And this plays into the national subconscious desire to make sure that we have not committed great crimes in Iraq, or given that we have obviously done so, that they were somehow justified.
Did you see this Harris poll that shows that something like 22% of the population, or is a little higher than that, roughly around that with margin of errors, still believe that weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq?
Well,
and
not
that,
only that.
There's another one that, another figure I think was marginally a little bit higher, that still something like one out of five people in this country still believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with planning 9/11. It's amazing that these statistics are still persistent.
Well,
it was a Harris poll, I guess.
And in fact, there is an active group that is trying to do a swift boat style approach to these issues, a group that claims to have no connection to either the Republican Party or the administration, but is busily buying advertising time across the country to say that yes, indeed, there were weapons of mass destruction, as they were found, there were chemical weapons and so forth, and indeed Saddam Hussein was giving aid and comfort to terrorists, and that the administration was right on this matter. This is the Wall Street Journal ran an article 2 days ago entitled "The Fight for Iraq," describing how a number of conservative groups, they focus on one in particular called "Move America Forward," are putting ads like this off around the country. Television commercial. I'm quoting now from the Wall Street Journal. The television commercials are attention grabbing. Newly found Iraqi documents show that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, including anthrax and mustard gas, and had extensive ties to Al-Qaeda. The discoveries are being covered up by those, quote, willing to undermine support for the war on terrorism to selfishly advance their shameless political ambitions, close quote.
And like this guy's appointed by Bush to do the investigation.
Well,
that's a PR firm out of Sacramento, I understand,
but this,
right?
There are a number of people associated with it, and this is, as I say, they're using precisely the methods that were used by the Swift Boat people against Kerry, and those commercials are going on around the country, not apparently in major media markets, as they say, but where a lot of people will hear them. So this may have something to do with the poll trends on Bush too.
Yeah, well, I think they're trying to reinforce that persistent view. And you know, you look at what Bush's approval rating is, how much percentage of that is people that still hold these views that his own people, and he even has at one point or another. Categorically, I remember it was in 10-point type on the cover of the Chicago Tribune, no weapons.
So. You're right that the Move American Forward group grows out of the West Coast. In fact, a number of people who are associated with it were associated with the recall of Gray Davis, the governor of California, and they're working to take over the congressional seat recently evacuated by Randy Duke Cunningham, the California representative who was the great friend of the defense industry and was too public about his friendship and indeed the large amounts of money the defense industry was going. Which is an interesting story in itself, by the way. I mean, for all that Cunningham's tearful apology was on television, no one has had much to say about exactly what the defense companies were and who was responsible in those companies for bribing this congressman. Yeah, yeah. They talk about his taking of the bribes, but not the bribing by the defense companies. So, you know, that's something I'd love to hear more about in the new year, too.
Yeah. Amy, as usual, knocked it out of the park a couple of times this week. She had an interview with Russell Mochaber, corporate crime reporter.
Right. And, very very good guy.
Yeah. He's talking about this deferred prosecution gambit that they're using with major corporate criminals, where it apparently was instituted originally in the federal law for deferring prosecution against minors, trying to give them a time to get better, to rehabilitate themselves in their youth. Well, these corporations, some of these are older than any of the lawyers on the case probably, but they get these deferred prosecution, and he recounts how many of these cases. A major accounting firm, I guess he's sort of pointing out, thinking that maybe they didn't want another Arthur Anderson phenomena to happen, where Arthur Anderson, since credibility and accounting was their what they were selling, the fact that they could have been charged criminally as they were, to do that again with another of the major accounting firms might make them disappear too. So they probably were just better connected than Arthur Anderson was, probably is what it was. But they got one of these deferred prosecution arrangements, and nobody really has to they just have to promise to do better. There are some fines levied, and some individuals are given criminal, but the corporation itself, which is structurally doing these things, is not given a criminal record, as it were.
The business of America is business, as a chief executive pointed out, one of the few to say what they all believed. There was an interesting story in Britain this week that points up just how unusual, in a way, the American position on issues like this really is. The new leader of the Conservative Party, David Cameron, appointed as his policy director, his chief policy spokesman, a man called Letwin, who has been part of the Tory government, part of the Conservative movement in Britain for a while. Letwin goes to the papers a week ago and says, well, of course, any new Tory government, any new Conservative government in Britain would have as one of its primary goals the redistribution of wealth. And everyone said, what?
To who?
From the rich to the poor. And he goes on in some detail about how, as a matter of simple justice, this is something we have to do, and so forth and so on. Well, now, remember the situation here. The great redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich in Britain happened under the Tory Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, just as it happened under Ronald Reagan in this country. And the present Labour government, as heirs of Thatcher, have studiously avoided is saying that they had any interest in redistributing wealth. When asked directly, so-called New Labour, that is the Labour Party of Tony Blair, has said that in spite of that they are a supposedly a socialist party in their roots, they have given up any idea that associated with the socialists of redistributing wealth from
Thatcher
the rich
light,
to the poor.
As they say.
But so the new Tory party says, yeah, that's our position. And for a week now, there have been rumblings in Britain about the fact that the Tories are on this issue substantially to the left of New Labour, and there are some Tories who are running around saying, oh no, we didn't mean we're going to tax the rich, but it seems very clear that the new leadership of the conservative party has not fallen into you know, this issue. They've embraced it purposely and publicly. And this is something, Paul, it's the discussion that's going on in Britain this last week is unimaginable in this country. It's unimaginable for either political party to say, we intend to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor.
I think the,
they just wouldn't do it. And certainly not the Republicans, but the Democrats, more like New Labour in this regard, wouldn't do it either.
I guess some of the Tories are probably suggesting this guy's probably using ecstasy again or something and is out of his head.
But the interesting thing is that this is what the new Tory party is talking about and that there's actually discussion going on the issue. Can you imagine a discussion on the issue in the U.S.?
No, that's class war. Can't do that.
Now, there you are.
I wanted to... Mark Kuiper was also on this show, Your Call, and went into further detail. Enron is the counterexample that they're actually getting somebody flipped and they're actually going to supposedly go after these folks as opposed to these this long, unchronicled history uncommented on by the regular press. I hadn't heard anything about these deals that were cut to allow corporations to pledge to be better in the future kind of thing. He also mentioned that a Lincoln War profiteering bill called False Claims is used by whistleblowers and other sorts that you can gain 20-30% of any money that's defrauded from the federal government if you, you know, provide evidence and lead to the prosecution, and that there are many of these in the Medicare and HMO realm that are out there, and one of the things that this we're hearing a lot about this Medicare Plan D business because it goes into effect tomorrow, I guess. But the budget-cutting Medicare bill that was passed with the vote of Cheney was the House-crafted one. Apparently, in this case, the Senate, the greatest deliberative body in the world, actually... what an outrageous thing that is to say.
I was going to say, you're being ironic again,
yeah,
Paul.
Yeah. But the bill that in the Senate actually included some of its savings by getting overpayment of HMOs and Big Pharma in line a little bit, and that they didn't completely take it out of the benefits to the poor and indigent and ill, whereas the House bill was crafted to that. And I wonder if this False Claims prosecutions that are going ahead are affected by this in any way. If you make it no longer illegal for these overcharges, or you authorize these overcharges, or these high costs from HMOs and Big Pharma, it's now legal and it doesn't have to be whistleblown on anymore. And apparently, that was part of what happened in that bit of late date charade in the Congress.
I've said for a while that the Bush administration is divided between looters and killers. The killers, roughly the neocons, want to kill people in the Middle East to protect the American control of the Middle East via Israel, and the general foreign policy that the U.S. has followed in the Middle East, whereas the looters are more interested in making sure that the well-to-do in the U.S. who put Bush in the White House continue to be well-to-do. And I think we may see this division exacerbated in the coming year, Paul, in part because there are indications, at least, that these business arrangements that you've been describing may be more and more necessary as the American economy turns down in 2006. There are worrisome signs that a lot of people think that the progress of the economy, and remember, when we talk about the progress of the economy, we mean the profits of rich people, according to the American journalistic convention, that the progress of the economy will in fact slow in the coming year. The Dow Jones average ended lower in 2005 than it began. That hasn't happened for a while. It wasn't much lower, but it was lower. A phenomenon occurred in the financial markets at the end of this year, a so-called inverted yield curve, where the interest rates on short-term treasury notes got above the interest rates in the long-term notes. This is an indication that people think that things don't look good down the road, that the American economy in 2006 may have serious problems indeed. American economy here understood, in this case, as the profits of American corporations.
Yeah, well, people are so not we may have to borrow out of
their making their arrangements to make sure that these things, you know, that they're battening down the hatches if there really is a bad time. In the meantime, as Paul Krugman said in quite a brilliant column this last week, I thought, everybody else knows what's going on in their economic life, and it's not good.
This division between the looters and the killers you bring up quite a bit, and I think that Dick Cheney is a good emblem of people that are both, and I think we have to worry about that. And you know, the home equity that people have been drawing on to make the economy go is drying up, and I think that people are looking at those kind of things for their predictions of what's going to be happening next.
Maybe another way to put it is to say that the Bush is not to see it as individuals as so much as conflicting policies. The imperial policies in the Middle East are getting away of the policies also dear to the heart of the Bush administration of enriching the small minority that it represents in the country.
So I wanted to throw this in. There's a new study from the Latin American Working Group. I've been going to them for advice about the Evo Morales Bolivian issue. It turns out narconews.com is a better source for a lot of stuff. They have a new story on Colombia that's quite interesting. But this Latin American Working Group, which is a D.C.-based think tank sort of thing, last year they issued a report called Blurring Lines, which discusses the confusion of military and policing roles in Latin America and how the Pentagon is taking over domestic and diplomatic policy all through Latin America, since I guess if you don't have cooperative governments, you deal with the people that you can talk to. They've now issued a second report this year called Erasing the Lines, which further asserts that it's even gotten worse, that U.S. military assistance is weakening civilian oversight, and I think they're drawing lines for a battle down there as well.
Have you heard about Operation Homefront? This is the source of this is the interesting Washington publication Capitol Hill Blue, which turns up stuff that you wonder, could that be the case? Anyhow, they have an article about the encouragement in the military of soldiers returning home, American military figures returning home for the holidays, and the necessity for them to go on their local television, talk to their local newspapers and so forth, to talk up the war in Iraq and to say what a good thing we're doing there, how well things are actually going, attack any reports people may have heard that things were not going well in Iraq, so forth. Soldiers, and this is other ranks as well as officers, are being told to talk to their local media on this subject. The real situation, in other words, more Pentagon obfuscation of what the real situation in Iraq is. If you'd like an account of the real situation, I suggest Patrick Coburn's piece in the current Counterpunch, summarized by the headline, Bush and Blair Plot Their Exit Strategy as the Nation, he means Iraq, Falls Apart at the Seams. Well, maybe he doesn't mean
Iraq. Goes over to Iran is one of his other theses in that article, I understand. Ripped from the headlines, the News Gazette has above the fold article, Soldier in Iraq is to speak at the American Legion post in this town on Monday. And Anderson says even though he lost his left arm, I guess, in Iraq, he generally supports Bush's decision to send troops to topple Saddam. So
I hope somebody will ask him how much he was encouraged by the military to go around and give these talks.
Yeah, what do they do? Do they give him bigger bonuses or something?
Well, Operation Homefront. That's exactly what they're doing. They're giving him bonuses. They're giving people I should post the article someplace, but I mean, you can find the
cursor
the
had a link to it. I didn't look get time
for,
to read to
look
it.
Look for Operation Homefront, which is what it's being called. And they are directly doing that. The military is giving benefits of various types to people who will go home on this holiday and talk to their local media about how the war in Iraq is a good thing, capital G, capital T. In terms of news management, too, there was a wonderful story this week about the AP reporter in Haiti, actually Stringer would be closer to the truth, the AP Stringer in Haiti, and Stringer both for the Associated Press and the New York Times, being a creature of the National Endowment for Democracy, that the U.S. was apparently paying, the U.S. government through the NED, was apparently paying the guy, although in this case actually it was a woman, who was the source of most of the stories that were in the Associated Press and the New York Times, few as they were, about what's been going on in Haiti since we overthrew the government. So,
paying Source Watch, PR Watch, all of these outfits, Media Matters, things like that, are trying to chronicle these stories. But they come, and Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, of course, too. One of the first Media Watch groups are trying to keep track of. They come so thick and fast.
Yep.
One wonders.
It's too true. I've got another story that I want to talk about in terms where things may not be quite what they seem and in the media reporting, and that one's closer to home. This is the McCain torture bill. There was much talk about the McCain torture bill and the torture amendment and the various bills it was attached to and how it finally rode through on the defense appropriation amendment. And people are saying, oh, wonderful John McCain, great stuff. Torture, really put that in black and white. Administration suffered a defeat on that and so forth. Maybe not. Maybe it's not quite so clear. What the media were not telling us much about at the same time was another amendment to these same legislative enactments, the Levin-Graham-Kyle amendment, which essentially eviscerates, I suppose that word is all too appropriate in this matter, the McCain anti-torture bill, because what it does is it says all well and good that you're outlawing torture in the McCain bill. First of all, the government, as we know, is perfectly capable of redefining torture in such a way that blatant lies about torture can be put forth by the Secretary of State in Europe. We don't torture. Well, if you define it correctly, I suppose we don't. In fact, the U.S. has a torture policy, a policy that's come from the top of this administration since the beginning of this war. But now what's happened in this Levin-Graham-Kyle amendment is that habeas corpus is removed from detainees at Guantanamo and apparently elsewhere, and that anyone who actually wanted to bring a court action under the prohibition of torture that the McCain amendment supposedly provides is prevented from doing so. So what they've done is they've taken with one hand what they've given with what they've ostensibly given with the other, and that part of it has been much much less reported than the supposed ban on torture.
It also stipulates that testimony gained under torture is not excluded, which is generally the practice. But generally the theory, I think, and practice, that's not been the case.
Well, there's a case of that in Britain this week, where the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan has actually published documents. He's going to be in some trouble, I think. Published documents showing how the British government and their friends in the U.S., in spite of their denials, were using evidence from torture in Uzbekistan. Right. This guy was the British ambassador to Uzbekistan and was removed when he talked about how Britain's good friends amongst the Uzbeks were torturing people. Now he's published documents showing that the British government was indeed using this information.
The military admitted this week that the number of Guantanamo Bay prisoners going in a hunger strike has gone up to 84. Now, since they've always been lowballing the figure, I presume that it's actually quite a bit higher.
I'm sure you're right.
It's probably 84 the ones that they're having to forcibly feed at this point, and they probably have to... they probably released the number just before they started forcibly feeding more, so they could at least try and lowball the number. But a little bit of information comes out through some communication with various lawyers, and that's done mainly through, I think, British attorneys. There's a story about how many British attorneys are actually getting involved in the U.S. legal system here and going after death penalty cases, etc. Alito's coming up, and he's among all of his other flaws. He's absolutely police friendly, as well as being friendly to the executive.
Primarily friendly to business. Yes,
there was one case where, well, I think he that may be the pivotal one, but he comes with all these other blessings from the neoconservative and the conservative point of view. He was overruled.
He's a looters man.
He was overruled in a position where he. it was about the conviction of a felony with an all-white jury where black jurors were impermissibly struck, and he suggested that the prosecution's exclusion of blacks from juries in capital cases, he compared that to statistical evidence of why a disproportionate number of recent U.S. presidents have been left-handed. So he's saying it's just an artifact or something.
I'm very bad at predictions of this sort, Paul, but I think they might beat him. I think Alito, as impeachment talk continues, as the administration's reputation declines in the new year, and as things like what you're pointing out continue to pile up around Alito, it might be able to make a pile big enough that it can be lighted, and he can be denied a seat on the court.
Well, that means it would go to a nuclear option, and whether it would depend on whether this gang of 12 actually does what they.
Well, that could be interesting too. That could be worthwhile. I mean, there are certainly fronts to fight on here, and certainly our go along Congress people should be memorialized on the point. Happy New Year to one and all, and inshallah, we'll be back next year to do the same thing.
Whatever your calendar is.
That's right.